Hello and welcome to the Bot Nirvana podcast, where we dive into all things software automation. I'm your host, Nandan Mullakra. While I'm not podcasting, I write articles on nandan.info. I hope you enjoy the show. Let's get right into it. We have Ian Barkin on the podcast today. Ian, as many of you know, was the co-founder of Symphony Ventures, which was an early RPA consulting firm. It was sold to Saix for $69 million in 2018. He has since co-authored the book Intelligent Automation and is the author of many LinkedIn learning courses on RPA, Intelligent Automation, and Process Mining. A well-known influencer, investor, and advisor, he shares his thoughts on the different facets of Intelligent Automation. Let's listen in. Hello, Ian. Welcome to the Bot Nirvana podcast. It's wonderful having you today. Can we start with a quick intro?
Yes, absolutely. Thank you so much for having me, Nandan. It's great to be here with you. Always enjoy chatting with you. Yes, brief intro. So I have always been in either outsourcing, shared services, or consulting industries, and always been focused on innovation and stuff that makes the way we do things better, hopefully better, newer, certainly, maybe better. And about 10 years ago, stumbled into the use of automation to emulate and augment the work people were doing. Didn't have a name necessarily at the time, but it came to be known as robotic process automation. And the rest is history, as they say. I was lucky enough to be able to give it a try, see that it worked. Then take a leap with some friends, co-found a company called Symphony Ventures, which was one of the earliest RPA boutique pure play consultancies. And for about 4 years, grew it into the largest of its kind, focused exclusively on helping enterprises understand, implement, manage, and support their digital labor force. With the use of all the leading brands in RPA that everyone's heard of, so not worth going over. And then we were lucky enough to then sell the company. We sold it to a company called Saix, where I became the chief strategy and marketing officer. And all the while followed, I guess, my personal passion, but also a sort of a pragmatic and useful passion to make noise, to put out content, to educate, to storytell. And so did that over the last 8 years, creating courses on RPA. What is it? How do you apply it? Creating courses and books on intelligent automation and advising, investing in what I hope are the game changers in the future of work. So, that's me.
So that's an amazing journey, right? And you've been a pioneer in RPA, as you said. You know, it's just been evolving into RPA. So congrats on the exit, by the way. That's an amazing, amazing thing. And so having seen the industry from the beginning and how it has progressed, what's your thoughts on where the industry is now? And are you happy with it?
Well, okay. So a few things. One, I saw it from an early stage in its application to a certain type of adopter. So in the 2012 timeframe, 12, 13, 14, it was BPOs primarily that started to experiment with this.
Right.
The vendors themselves predated that, in some cases by up to 10 years. Right. So the vendors have been around and solving these problems before, but in more discrete, smaller ways. So I was... In case anyone cares about the esoteric history of it, I wasn't at the beginning, but I got to be at the beginning of a particular stage in the adoption. And it was exciting just because it was like that next big lever you could pull. Clients around the world had been pulling a centralization lever, a continuous improvement lever, so shared services, Six Sigma, Lean, Kaizen. And then they'd been pulling the near and offshore levers of tapping into talent in places that weren't within their walls or even within their geographical region. And those were all really cool times and spelled innovation and disruption. And then RPA came about. And that was equally as exciting, perhaps even more, because it was tech plus talent and people.
Right.
The narrative early on was a bit dark in so much as it's robots that can replace people. A lot of that narrative has gone away now. You see much more around augmenting, supercharging, enabling, et cetera. But what do I think about the industry now? Unfortunately, hype gets balls rolling, but hype also creates all sorts of friction and sometimes just destroys the ball, unfortunately.
Yeah.
And so you've seen an environment in which the early hype that got a lot of the companies going and got a lot of the early pilots and proofs of technology, proofs of concepts, got them going, has set expectations inappropriately.
Right.
And so you have a lot of people who think the technology is more capable than it is currently. And probably worse, you have a lot of people who think this journey is easier than it is.
Right.
And so I think there's speculation about the death or the demise or the slowing or the sort of the irrelevance of some of these tools. It has nothing to do with the tool itself. The tech is great. The people who developed them are smart as hell. But the messaging got in the way of honest assessments, honest solution designs, and honest application. And so therefore, you come up with all these, Lord knows how they come up with the numbers, but all these pretty shocking numbers of percentage failure. 40, 60, 75% of digital transformations fail. And so that's where we are right now. Good tech, poorly marketed, oversold, and under prepared for, but hopefully we're going to catch a second wind, and we're at a chance where the level-headed and the experienced can come in and actually structure solid journeys and solid paths that get us to where we could have gotten 5 years ago if we hadn't sort of made so much noise with hype and overpromise.
Yeah, gone down the wrong path, so to speak, right? And with the messaging, and that messaging has been a killer, because I've seen that personally doing this at various organizations, that there is employee resistance that has come up because the whole message has been that it will remove employees. So it's not just employees, but the management too is like, oh my God, I'm going to lose my team, and then what will I do? So that then I'll be the next to go, right?
Yes.
Which has been realized, right?
Yeah. Well, it was interesting for a few different reasons. One, just the mechanics of math made it much easier to say one FTE costs X amount, and if I can remove them, right, I save X amount. Right. And so the equation made it easier. And the alternative was much more esoteric of it's going to create value. It's going to give people time back in their day so they can focus on higher value adding activities. It's, while robust in its logic, it was harder to build models around. And so it was just easier to say, a robot, if it does work 24/7, is being pitted against one of your employees who works 8 hours a day, which is, one third of 24/7. And do they really work 8 hours a day? And they only work 5 days, not 7 days a week. And so you can sort of, it's like a business school logic interview. Like, you can sort of logic your way into the fact that robots are going to be a hell of a lot more effective. Right. But then you forget, as you said, the enterprise psychology around the importance and the value of teams to their leadership and resistance and so it's been interesting to see how our measurements and mechanisms for articulating value from automation augmentation has evolved as we've evolved.
Right. And you rightly put it, hopefully we'll get a second chance, right? And we were talking of cricket before we started, and there's a I don't know if you know, but there's a concept of a second inning. So there's a first innings and there's a second innings where the team comes again for batting. And, you know, you've learned, you're matured. So there's more things you can implement in the second inning. So hopefully we get our second innings. But as we get our second innings, so what's your thoughts on the second innings and how we can get it right?
Sure. So we did, just to expand on that cricket discussion, I was telling you I don't understand cricket at all. So thank you for using it as an analogy. Now I have to relate to it.
That's why I explained that.
Yes, thank you. Thank you very much. It's a bit dramatic, but I mean it with all of my soul, which is I generally tell enterprises, you don't get a third chance to succeed at digital transformation.
Right.
And what I mean by that, if they can infer, is they've screwed up the first chance. That's just, I know, they've screwed it up. I mean, has 40% of them screwed it up? Has 70%? I'd go out on a limb and say they've all screwed it up. So the first chance they screwed up. So now they're in the act of sort of rallying resources, picking tools, hiring talent to go and try it again. It's the second chance.
Yeah.
And if they don't get this one right, I don't think they'll have another chance. Right, they won't be given yet another budget, yet more air cover, and yet more time to digitize operations a third time. So pressure's on. Mm-hmm. And so what do you do to get the second chance right? I've got some strong opinions about it, but ultimately, if you look back at what made the first chance not work and use that as some of your guide to what you should do differently, then you see some pretty clear indications of sort of better practices. So one of them is around just education, enterprise-wide stakeholder education. Is you can't have some people believing this is absolute magic and does what it says on the tin, which is what the marketing team said, you know, sentient AI bots that self-procreate clean data, infer and recommend outcomes and automate automatically upon process mining what you do today, right? If you believe that shit, then I can't help you.
Right.
So you need everyone to be generally educated about the rules of physics and what intelligent automation is at a sort of a generic level, and then what some of the capabilities can do. So that's one. Communication was the other area where everything fell apart. Is you've got stakeholders across your organization. This can't be rogue business people hiding this on a desktop because they don't want IT getting in their way. It also can't be IT of strong arming and pushing this stuff through, because what do business people know? This is software, so it's naturally going to be an IT remit, right? So you need to understand that more so than ever, that an enterprise is a software company. Everything about an enterprise, whether you're business or IT or customer service or what have you, you're a component in that software ecosystem and reality that you're living in. So you need to honor the fact that all of these are stakeholders, and you need to communicate with them what it is that you intend to be doing. What are you actually trying to achieve? You need to choose better targets, because that whole, we can get rid of 20% of our operating headcount in our call center if we can automate it, isn't a compelling target internally. Doesn't really matter to the market, and just doesn't energize. Better targets around things like higher revenue, more efficient revenue, so higher profits, or just better customer and employee experience, which then creates all of those things. Right? If people are happier, they will buy again from you, and they will buy again from you, making that sale cheaper than the last one. So better targets. And then I think what we just need to do is we need to become more pragmatic about our selection of partners. And I mean both technology partners and service partners. Straight up, we've been lied to a lot by software vendors. I understand the purpose. I understand why they do it. I understand the metrics that drive their behaviors. But it hasn't helped. And in fact, it's dramatically hurt an industry that you and I care so very much about, Nandan.
Yeah.
So we need that. And then we also need to understand other partners. You can't automatically expect people in your organization to be experts in something they've never done before.
True.
And so you do need to understand that there's value in learning from experts who have done it before.
Yeah.
Especially because you don't get a third chance to fail at digital transformation. This is the time that you've got to get it right.
Yeah. There's no third innings even in cricket.
Exactly. Ah, I love that one. Okay. I'm writing that down. There's no third inning in cricket. And then I'm going to go figure out why and what that means, because there are nine innings in baseball. So why are there not?
Yeah, it's not a baseball. Take it as a cricket.
Okay. So if digital transformation were baseball, you'd have tons of extra chances to get this right. But if it's cricket, you really only, okay. I like that. That helps me with that analogy.
Analogy. That's really, yeah. So there you get it. So
I like it.
So I think, you know, all that you mentioned, a common thread is people, you know, whether it is expert, whether it's messaging, whether it's best practices. And I keep telling people, and we just started a club in Bot Nirvana, and you know, this is what we do. I mean, we've been discussing about unlearning. One of the first step, I think, in the second inning is unlearning what we have learned or been indoctrinated to in the first step, right? So it's been an indoctrination. And the reason we have this separate community and just away from the social media is that you know, we can unlearn this indoctrination that has happened, right? And that hype is still continuing. I mean, so, you know, so the idea is that we have a safe space where we can talk about it.
Yes.
I've heard from people who have actually spent like 3 years, 5 years trying to get it right, following this path that people have been telling them, and just been a dead end. And they've been following consultants, they've been following vendors who actually took them the wrong way, but they learned out of it. So the whole idea is not everyone to reinvent the wheel, right? And build it again.
Totally. Well, there's no shame in learning, and there's no shame in making mistakes. That's how you learn.
Right.
The only things I think I remember today are things what that I learned the hard way.
Yeah.
I don't remember anything that went right. I remember everything that went wrong. And so so there is no shame in that. You're right. And it's important that you embrace it and reflect back on what it's taught you, and not tie your particular identity to the decisions you made in the past, because this is a chance to sort of reboot a bit.
Yeah. And I think also that, you know, from a social media perspective, what happens is that, you know, you can't share your failures there, right? I mean, it's not in interest of any of the vendors or the consulting companies or even the people. So, okay. Yeah. Please continue. You're saying.
Yeah, no. And you're very right. Which is why I'm so surprised when people report that 70% of digital transformations fail. I mean, that had to be reported by the people who failed. So, which is why I also think the 30% is also wrong, because that's people who would be, of course, would find it hard to admit that it didn't go as well as they'd hoped it would. So, there's that. There's a safe community is so valuable because there's a lot to be learned from people who have touched different parts of this elephant,
right?
And so people who are, as long as you can sort of separate yourself from your particular role, right? I mean, that's kind of what's been a little bit sort of liberating about the position I'm in right now, is I'm not selling anything. I've got nothing to sell. I just get to be grumpy and hopefully useful and experienced. People in a lot of those forums, people didn't want to be sold to, and so they wouldn't let consultants in. And unfortunately, the consultants are the ones who were racking up all of the trench experience, because they're the ones who were going from project to project to project, to vendor promise to vendor promise to client expectation to client expectation. So they've gathered a ton of experience, but their livelihood depends on them selling that experience and working with clients, and so. So there's always going to be a sales element to that. That's just the rules of nature. But they do know a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Similarly, enterprises that have done this internally have also learned a great deal now too, because they also have, any large organization has a number of very predictable things that have gone on over the last 5, 6, 7, 8 years that they can share with others.
Right.
Right. They've got multiple different types of RPA robots happening in all the different fiefdoms and you know, pockets in their business because different rogue people decided to make their own buying decisions. They've struggled with the same sort of data issues, the same sort of control issues of only having autonomy over certain systems, the communication issues that, I mean, they've struggled with them all. So to have a chance like you've pulled together, which is so exciting, a community that can share those experiences and hopefully learn from them is invaluable.
Yeah, I think so too. And I hope, you know, we have more such forums where we can discuss things openly and you know, go past this hype, right? And you did mention an elephant, right? That's a good analogy, like the blind men, if you've seen that thing, you know, different people look at different part of the elephant and then they're like, yeah, I think this is this, right? And so people have been like, yeah, automation means RPA, or somebody is like, no, automation means BPM. No, it's automation means AI. But I'm so happy now in terms of where we are going, because even when I started this whole journey on RPA, which we call RPA, and you know, six, 7 years back, we were doing all these things, whether it's BPM or AI, everything was part of it. It's not just RPA even at that point of time. But now at least Gartner has named it, and Forrester has named it. Gartner calls it as hyper automation. And then Forrester calls it as an automation fabric, similar concept, though they're defining different things. Yes. But I wanted to switch tracks and talk about this whole automation fabric. And I love the automation fabric, by the way, better than hyper automation, though it's the same thing of, you know, this whole ecosystem is coming together now. Yes. And it's creating a, what Forrester calls as a fabric to enable what, like you're calling, you know, better automations or better even digital transformations, though that term means nothing, but you know, but yes, it enables that, right? But one interesting facet of that, what I notice, and this is something I heard from the Forrester analysts talk about it, is that we are putting together an ecosystem of a lot of low code tools. I was talking to an AI vendor today morning. He is actually doing ML, auto ML, ML ops. So everyone is converging towards a way where technology can be done easier, right? And so this is all like a building of putting together of Lego blocks. And what it's enabling is a creator economy within the enterprise. And that was an interesting thing to hear, because what we're enabling is different facets of automation, which you can, with as a business person, as a developer, as a citizen developer, you can actually put this together and build out an solution. Build out a solution that helps your business. It's, need not call it automation, though Forrester does call it, is say that automation is the app. So you're basically building out apps during using different components.
Yes.
So I wanted to talk about that whole creator economy that's coming up, because I know you're passionate about the whole creator economy. And so, you know, how do you see this evolving? Do you think there's an enterprise also we are creating creator space for people within the enterprises to come up with such creations, if so to speak, or express themselves?
Yeah. So it's I've got a lot to say about this, and it's a great question. The adoption of RPA in the earliest days really was by business users who wanted to solve problems that they implicitly felt and saw they dealt with every day. It was It was transactional friction and inefficiency and just annoyance. And so and IT wasn't, either was busy or didn't see the value in committing the resources. And so business people had a perception of what they could do to make value happen, and they wanted to matter to themselves and their teams and their enterprise. And so they used these tools to matter. And I think that's at the heart of all of this, is that everybody who cares about their job wants to matter and wants to have an impact. And so that citizen developer concept really sits there for me. is it's people who want to bring their ingenuity and their understanding of their clients and the systems in which they work and the processes by which they have to adhere. They want to bring that all to work in the morning, and they want to make a difference. And so if there are tools that allow them to do that when they might not be comfortable, you know, coding, those tools are going to help the organization overall. If is the critical part here. If there is some sort of structure and nurturing incubation within the organization.
Right.
Because I think flying cars are awesome. I've always wanted a flying car. We've been talking about flying cars for 50 years. If you gave normal people flying cars, that shit would fall out of skies and hit houses and other cars on the ground, bump into power lines, and we'd be in trouble, right?
Right.
If you give people in an enterprise the ability to digitize things just because the technology's there, it doesn't mean that cars aren't going to fall out of the sky. It doesn't mean they aren't going to digitize a process and wreak incredible amounts of havoc in the enterprise because they don't know about change control. They don't know about other regulations and policies and restrictions that the IT group generally and someone in risk has been maintaining and protecting for the organization. So the citizen development concept is interesting. It's energizing and it's frightening as hell. Most IT folks roll their eyes at it because they just feel like these business folks ultimately don't get the more complex side of IT, and they just create technical debt wherever they go unless we handhold them. And so making tools easier gives more and more people who want to matter and have that sense of how they might be able to matter. It gives them a chance to play, right? It gives them a chance to start to apply these tools. But there needs to be a very robust sort of set of elements in place for that to be reasonable for a business. And so, yes, while I love the sort of the analogy of relating citizen developers to creators, of people who have inspiration, who want to tell a story or create something valuable. I love the analogy, but this isn't just me putting up cat videos on YouTube Shorts because I can and I like cats, which I do not, by the way. For the record, for anybody listening to this, I'm a dog person, okay. But I don't think that's relevant to the point I'm making. You do need more regulation if somebody's going to say, like, I really hate hitting this button all the time when I'm doing payroll, so I'm going to digitize that. And then, like, 3 weeks later, you issue 3 checks for every employee because someone digitized it by themselves without oversight or control. So that's why the time we're in is so interesting, because low code, no code is a lot more than just ease of technical application. It is the spirit of contribution and creativity and a chance to matter.
Right.
To this day, low code, no code is still somewhat complex. It's not as simple as building a graphic with Canva or a website with a website developer. So it's still harder, but it's getting easier. I guess the only thing I'd say is that the ease is useful to, like, DevOps. It's useful to technical people who do know and do understand the technical element, but there are parts they'd love to just have handle themselves or be faster and simpler. So that's a good first step. But organizations have to invest heavily in what their citizen development approach is going to be, and then invest heavily in education and invest heavily in championing those innovators internally who see potential opportunity to make things better and help them to do that. And if it gets a little tough or gets a little technical, have the resources there to continue the journey and help them along the way and reward them for their innovation and their ingenuity. Because that way you'll create a loyalty within your teams that every enterprise depends on right now, given how many people are leaving their jobs.
Yeah. And I totally agree with you. And we need the guardrails, we need the framework. And I've been a skeptic myself. And I've always said that, you know, the low code doesn't mean anything like drag and drop. It's all hyped by the marketing teams, right? And we do need people. But hearing from people now, like, you know, like you said, you were interviewing people. I've been talking to many people. I see people do this very successfully now, and it's amazing. I'm actually having a podcast coming out soon with a person called Brian Klotchkoff. He is with Dentsu, an advertising company, a huge advertising company. And he was talking about how they have made it possible. I've heard of many people, you know, they're running hackathons within the organization, getting ideas, and then they have a team which guides a set of business technologists who do it. So there's an emerging team of people within marketing, within finance, who are more, you know, interested in technology, and which Gartner now started calling as business technologists, who can actually understand and who, you know, who can do these things better, right? And they're more interested in it. So, and you know, they are, Gartner also calls it as fusion teams. So I think that is evolving. So I think, yes, you know, we just introduced flying cars and we have had so many crash. I think we'll, and then we are building the guardrails around it. So it's like building an aeroplane, you know, as we are flying, because I think that that's really needed, because technology suddenly became business and we need more technologists. And so we need more people to contribute. And so I think that will happen. But at the end of the day, I am now turning a supporter of this whole creative enterprise, creative, you know, I don't want to call it economy, but, you know, this creative initiative within the enterprise.
So I think one of the most impactful things RPA did for enterprises, and I'll relate this back to something I did 10 years prior. So in ancient history, I was in BPO. I was a solution architect. I designed deals, and then if we won them, I would stick around and help transform them. And so happened to win one, had a team of 1,000 people all over the planet in several different delivery locations. And we ran this innovation competition. Mm-hmm. But before we did it, we had everybody trained as a yellow belt in Six Sigma.
Okay.
And it was like half an hour of just like, what are the terms stand? Like, what is DMAIC? What do the letters mean, and how can you look through? Ultimately, the point is it gave them a lens. It gave them a new lens through which to look at things that they may have been doing for quite a long time.
Right.
And it's amazing how powerful a new lens can be while looking at the same landscape. And RPA served as that new lens for so many. And these hackathons and innovation competitions serve as a new lens as well. If what precedes a hackathon is an element of education, right? I taught everyone what DMAIC is. RPA hopefully taught everyone, you know, is it routine? Is it mundane? Is it transactional? Is it digitized data upstream? Is it measurable outcomes downstream? And if it met those criteria, all of a sudden, that could be a good candidate. And so again, this intelligent automation or fabric or hyper automation or whatever it is, as long as you commit to educating people responsibly, you've provided them a lens through which to look at what they do, and all sorts of ideas will come out. Then, to your point, then you need to be there with them to help actualize and create this, either to help further workshop the idea, right? You've identified the pain. Now let's turn that into opportunity. Now let's turn that into solution. Now let's turn that into action plan of what we're going to develop to make that outcome happen.
Right.
And if you can do that, that's powerful. And I think that's what's so exciting. That's why I spend so much time educating myself. It's why I've got the courses I do. It's why I wrote the book that I did, is because I think the biggest impact here is that lens and that awareness.
Yeah, and thank you so much for doing that part. You've been doing it even before all these things were sexy, so to speak, right? Like when I've seen your course first on what is RPA.
I think it's sad that you think intelligent automation and RPA is sexy, but okay, fine, we'll go with it.
like it or not, you know.
There we go. It is exciting. I do agree, but no, it's always been a passion. I I feel like you and I have that same drive. You love educating and teaching and sharing what you know and what you've learned and earned, and that's spectacular. It's so valuable to your community. So
yeah, but I think what we are doing differently also is, you know, going beyond the hype. You know, yeah, like you said, you know, the hype makes it sexy, but you know, there's something more beyond that hype, and that's what you're doing. And so thank you for that. And I did see you have an you just told me about intelligent automation course. And then you also have a process mining course, which came up, and you're coming up with a process discovery course. So that is an interesting area, right? Process mining and discovery. So yesterday we had this club meeting and we had a vote in terms of we had like 20 trends and what's the biggest one. And everyone like overwhelmingly voted for process mining. And I was not expecting that actually. Awesome. So in your mind,
every one of them should watch my new class and then it and give it 5 stars.
Yeah, please do. Yeah, because we should get that right too. So that's another space where hype is picking up. So many terms coming up now, right?
Yep.
So now that's where I wanted to come to: process mining versus discovery. What's your take on that?
It's unfortunately, I think the definition, again, we have too many tools anyway, and it's too confusing already. And to have more come in and further, like, that distinction matters so little to most people,
right?
Of whether it's, and again, you got process already, because, you know, already off the top of my head, you have task mining, process discovery, process intelligence.
Yeah.
And so which is a subset of the other ultimately? At the end of the day, the reason I created the one course and then the other, that's the process mining and the process discovery course, was to help people understand, first and foremost, this evolution. This isn't new, right? There was, you know, manufacturing sort of modeling and science around time studies, and then business process modeling nomenclature. Automation contributed a little bit to it, but it really is the beneficiary of better modeling of what it is you do. It's also important to point out that, you know, traditionally it was just sample sizes. You were talking, I mean, in the BPO era, you would do, knowledge capture, cascade, ramp up and go live. You would have three people head over to someplace domestic and sit side by side with the process owners, the experts, and then go home and cascade that knowledge to a bunch of other people. Right. And you just hoped to God that three people that you listened to were doing it the best way and the most compliant way. And because you were inheriting that for at least for a little while until your team started to have its own opinions about how to do things differently. That was what RPA was in the early days too. We would just have analysts sit down, you know, okay, Nandan, you are the payroll processor. Tell me what you do. Like, when you come in the morning, which systems do you open? Which, you know, which tabs do you go to? Which steps do you follow? But you can guarantee if a team has two people, the process is being done three ways, right? You just know, however many people you've got, it, there's nuance to it. Right. And so tools that help model that behavior are valuable, but are not the answer. Mm-hmm. Because all it tells you is an as-is state. And that's actually the episode I'm recording right now, is a discussion about what as-is is and not what it could be or maybe. That's a different exercise altogether. The reason so it's powerful, but it can't, again, if you market it as magic, if you market it as the thing that's going to tell you exactly what you do and what you should do going forward, then you're doing a disservice to the evolution of our space. Mm-hmm. And so that's important. The other reason I became fascinated with process mining originally is just because the process mining narrative was you don't need expensive consultants. You can just use the software and it'll automagically tell you what you're doing and where the bottlenecks are. And so it was initially a threat to my business when we were back in the opportunity assessment phase. But like every other sort of hyperbolic threat, it just doesn't manifest that way. You need people now as much, if not more so than ever before, to understand and leverage the tools that then teach you how to look at the tasks and the processes and then use that information to then ask yourself, this is what we do today. Is it achieving that which we want to accomplish tomorrow? And then how do we use what we now know to design a better future?
Yeah. And yeah, hype is everywhere, right? And you had a great point there that we'll, if we are messaging process mining wrong again, you know, we are doing a big disservice. Better learn from RPA and
yes,
position these things right. So, and accurately so that, and it's a very transparent world now, right? And so people come to know anyway. So
yes,
let's be real.
And there's this interesting discussion about how much do you need to know? I just had this discussion with a founder of a process intelligence firm. Do you need absolute fidelity? Do you need 100% knowledge of every single thing that's going on in your organization? Or do you need less, but then what you really need is recommendation, right? Mm-hmm. You don't need a really, really detailed map of the entire mountain range. You need a trail map of where you need to go.
Yeah.
And so there's got to be a balance there too of just understanding pragmatically what the technology can do, yeah, what it will cost to get there. Because a lot of the feedback now that's coming from some of the folks I'm hearing is, you know, like any other project, it takes a year, mm-hmm, heavy integration, lots of training, and we're not sure what we got from it. And that's not to criticize the technology, that's to criticize the expectations set and yeah, the message shared at the beginning of that project.
Yeah. And it's also this whole school of thought that, you know, machines or whatever product that we are building should do everything, right? It's like the self-driving car, right? Like your Tesla,
yeah,
actually drives quite a lot automatically, but you know, it's 80%, 90% there. So use that, right? And then let people be in control. So I think it has to be people first, and technology is enabling the people to do the things.
Totally agree. And people empowered are powerful people.
Exactly.
I gotta write that down. Yeah, that was good. Okay, hold on. Let's see if I can remember what I just said.
You said people empowered. Yeah.
People empowered are powerful people. You heard it here first. And so it's those people who both just understand that you value the contributions that they make, and you're actually enabling them to make those contributions by taking the mundane off their hands.
Right.
And not only that, but then you're allowing them to really play a bigger role. Hopefully your culture is comfortable enough to give them that remit, but you allow them to play a bigger role in redesigning what you do.
Yeah.
You know, and some of this derives from my experience in like call centers. Hmm. Like call center agents are some of the most battered human beings on the planet. It's not an easy job.
Right.
And yet I would chance a guess that there isn't a single person on God's green earth who understands your customer better than a call center agent.
Yeah.
And so how do you true up those two things? A role you want to pay as little as possible and constrain as much as possible with average handle times and things like that, with the fact that that is the most nuanced and informed experience about like what makes your customers happy or pissed off or likely to dump you and your product or likely to buy again and tell all their friends about it.
Yeah.
So yeah, those are the people you want to supercharge.
Yeah. And I mean, those are the people we want to make powerful, right? You're right. Empowering them, empowering the agents, right? Empowering the agents, and they can be so much more useful, like you say, bringing out their human skills that, you know, which can help the business grow a lot. So yeah, I think that's an awesome place to end this on. So thank you so much, Ian, today for sharing your thoughts. And before we go, where can people find you and reach you?
Where can people find me? That's a great question. The only answer ever is LinkedIn. Okay. I'm not cool enough to be on TikTok quite yet. But yes, so please do find me on LinkedIn. I've got four classes on LinkedIn, working on my fifth right now. But Intro to Robotic Process Automation, RPA, AI, and Cognitive Tech for Leaders, Intelligent Automation Foundations, which launched 2 weeks ago, and Process Mining for RPA, which just launched yesterday. And follow me, connect with me, share your stories with me. I'd love to hear from you. Nothing energizes me more than interacting with our community and sharing what I know, but even more importantly, learning from others like yourself, Nandan. And thank you for having me and for sharing your experiences with your community and for you pulling your community together. I'm really excited about it. And I know it's already hugely helpful, and it will continue to be even more helpful to anyone trying to be a worker of the future and the future of work.
Okay. Thank you so much, Ian. And thanks for all the kind words. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining the Bot Nirvana podcast. Appreciate if you can leave a review on iTunes or Stitcher. Catch the show notes on botnirvana.org. While you're there, feel free to explore more automation ideas, tutorials, tools, and more. See you next time.